funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the history of the Arab world and its people affect day-to-day events in the present? While the recent uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya took many Western analysts by surprise, historian Eugene Rogan's 2009 book, The Arabs, A History, Albright predicted the demands for greater human rights and government accountability by people who had endured centuries of foreign rule and control followed by oppressive domestic leadership. Eugene Rogan is director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford. His book now is out in trade paperback with an updated postscript, and he's with us this hour to talk about it. Eugene, welcome to THINK.
It's wonderful to be with you.
How long has this massive ethnic group been identifying itself as Arab, and what has the term come to mean over centuries?
I think the Arabs have seen themselves as a distinct people since the moment that Islam brought them into world history, and really from the 7th century down to the present day. The Arabs have been self-conscious of their identity and have kind of made their presence felt around the Mediterranean world.
You begin your exploration of Arab history in the early 16th century when the Ottomans seized control of most of the Arab world. What sort of leadership and political systems had existed before that time?
The standard form of government, and the Ottomans still represented this, was a kind of transnational empire. The Arabs had emerged as a Muslim empire, an Arab-led empire of people from different sort of ethnic groups that were absorbed as they moved their way up through the Arabian Peninsula into the Eastern Mediterranean, the area around Syria, up into what were then the territories of the Christian Byzantine Empire, and across North Africa, absorbing along the way Egyptians, Berbers, into the Iberian Peninsula, where they absorbed the indigenous people of what is now Spain and Portugal. And so in this, you had this great melting pot of peoples coming under Arab Islamic rule, and the first empires were the Umayyads, followed by the Abbasids, a certain amount of fragmentation as you have new empires emerging under the Ayyubids, like Saladin, the famous Saladin, or the Mamluks, who are the actual the rulers displaced by the Ottomans, where my book begins in the 1500s.
So essentially, when the Ottomans come in, this is a humiliating loss of self-determination for Arab peoples.
Well, in a sense, it was just a massive change of who was calling the shots. Mm-hmm. It was still an Islamic empire. The people in the Arab world had grown used to Turkish-speaking people dominating their militaries and telling their viziers what to do. That was already the case in the Abbasid Empire that ruled Baghdad in the 1200s. But what was different now in sort of 1516, 1517, was that for the first time the Arab world came to be ruled not from its own great cities like Damascus or Baghdad or Cairo, but from Istanbul, ancient Constantinople, which was, you know, the bridgeway between Asia and Europe, and very far away from the Arab lands. And I think that's the big momentous change that marked the beginning of the modern age for the Arab world.
Now, as late as the 19th century, there weren't any clear definitions of national identity within the Arab world. How did people sort of define themselves? Was it tribal? Was it religious? Was it according to language?
Yeah, I think that the ways people identified themselves tend to be much more local in the Arab world, as was common right through Europe before nationalism led to the emergence of big countries like Germany or Italy out of small city-states. The same would have been true in the Arab world, and people identified themselves by the town of their origin or the region. If you came from, let's say, Mount Lebanon, you might be called a Lubnani. If you were from Cairo, they might call you a Cairiot, or they might even identify the specific neighborhood in Cairo you came from. But people really identified themselves more by face-to-face community than by bigger national identities like an ethnic group of Arabs.
So how did the rise of Western-style nationalism creep into the Ottoman Empire, and then how did that start to affect Arab self-identity?
Well, nationalism was one of those big ideas that emerged really from the European Enlightenment as something that bonded people together as a political common cause. And those ideas gained ground right around the Mediterranean world and proved really erosive to the power of the big multinational empires like the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Russian Empire or indeed the Ottoman Empire. And so one big part of the 19th century history of the Ottomans is watching their empire dissolve under the demands of nationalist movements, particularly in the Balkans, starting with Greece, but then the emergence after Greece's successful bid for separation of nationalist movements in Bosnia, Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Romania, all countries that would emerge as sort of the result of nationalist movements in the course of the 19th century.
And the Europeans, in particular the French, recognized this as a weakening of the power of the Ottoman Empire.
I think the great powers of Europe were all convinced that the Ottoman Empire was an anachronism, and that it was no longer in mastery of the technology of warcraft. It was being left behind by changes in statecraft. And so you had a growing discourse around Europe about Turkey being the sick man of Europe. And the one country that really didn't want to encourage that discussion was Britain. Because Britain, coming out of the experience of the Napoleonic Wars and the divisions that racked Europe at the beginning of the 19th century, was determined to keep the Ottoman Empire together, fearing that were it to collapse, Russia, Germany, France, Britain would all be at each other's throats fighting over strategic territories that were in Ottoman domains. So in a roundabout way, Britain became very protective of the Ottoman Empire, less because it liked the Turks than because it wanted to preserve the peace in Europe.
Okay, people, I hope will forgive me for skipping over centuries of history here, but we do only have an hour. I want to go to World War One. World War One and the Arab Revolt wrested control of much of the Arab world away from the Ottoman Empire. It would have seemed that that victory would have promised a bright future for Arab states, but then you have Britain and France essentially dividing up the spoils of war.
Well, there was a real sense in the Arab world going into that war that the Ottoman Empire was here to stay. And in the course of the war, they realized that a very different future was emerging of a post-Ottoman world. The Ottomans had been ruling Arab lands for over four centuries at this point. It was as hard for them to imagine a post-Ottoman world as maybe for those of us who are children of the Cold War, it was difficult to imagine a post-Soviet world or a world of a united Europe. But that was what they were coming to. It was one of those great moments where the plate tectonics of history shift. And without much preparation for trying to put together their own bids for independent statehood, they realized that they were going to be facing a moment where the Ottomans were gone and they could make a bid to rule themselves. And their real inspiration in this moment wasn't Britain or France, but the America of Woodrow Wilson, and particularly the vision he articulated in 14 points of a new world order in which the self-determination of peoples would really set the standard of what was acceptable statehood.
Yeah, an interesting time in that not only was the United States seen as not an enemy, but in fact an ally, but a great example of the way this could be done.
And the message from Washington, from that very influential joint session of Congress where Wilson pronounced his vision of a new international order, really reached right across Africa, Asia, the Middle East. I found reports in papers kept by the then very isolated king of Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud, of conversations he had with a traveling Syrian who informed him about the pronouncements from Washington. We have to remember, we think of ourselves as such a superpower, the United States, but in 1914, 1918, America was a relatively modest power in world affairs, and it was something of a newcomer to the world stage. So it was the great unknown. The one thing people in the Arab world knew was that America had shown no interest in acquiring territory in their part of the world. And in that, they were seen as an honest broker. And in Wilson's vision of a new world order and his 14 points, they were seen as being a moral state. And so in this, America really was seen as the country that the Arab world was most attracted to in the West.
What sort of input did Arab peoples themselves have in the way that borders were determined after the Arab Revolt and after World War One?
Well, I think for many in the Arab world, they were trying to make sense of what would be a kind of viable size of state for their different regions. And there were a lot of different visions out there. Remember, they didn't have a lot of time to plan for independence. So some thought, well, our history has always been determined around empires, so all the Arabs should make one country. And that was the vision of the Sharifs of Mecca, Sharif Hussein, who led the Arab revolt.
This sort of pan-Arab world.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That, the Arabs had tended to be ruled from a great Arab capital as one state. So that would be a logical future for the Arab world after the Ottomans. Others saw in the sort of the provinces of Mesopotamia that become Iraq a kind of natural Arab state. Others saw in Greater Syria, which would be now the modern states of Lebanon, Syria, Israel, the Palestinian territories, and Jordan, another sort of viable state. Ibn Saud was already consolidating a lot of the Arabian Peninsula under his rule. So there was an idea that you could have sort of three or four states emerge in the Arab lands, and there were people agitating for this. And they all descended on Paris to try and get the attention of the decision makers at the Paris Peace Conference to try and lobby for their visions. But this is where we come against the kind of spoils of war vision that Britain and France brought to the table, where they really saw an opportunity to expand their empires into areas that they'd always seen as of strategic interest to them, and just wanted to try and make a rational partition without any real consideration for allowing people to determine their own political futures.
Eugene Rogan is my guest. He's director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford. His book is called The Arabs, A History. It was originally published in 2009 and is out now in trade paperback with an updated conclusion. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jeff Winnington is with us now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much for being with us, you folks listening right now. Thanks so much for hanging in there with us during this membership campaign. The great news is we are just $84,059 away from successfully concluding the spring membership campaign. You know, the truth is we've done over $120,000 in a day before because many of you like to wait until what is the last day. I believe just from the several years of working on these campaigns that we could do this today. We'll definitely probably make it tomorrow, but we're not going to make it to the conclusion unless we hear from you at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. We have been hearing from folks, Chris, at the higher membership levels, the Friends level, $1,500 a year. We occasionally get gifts of $3,000 or $5,000 during the pledge drive. And imagine what a huge chunk that would knock out of this $84,000 left if someone right now made a leadership gift in support of this show and in support of KERA of $3,000 or $5,000. If that's right for you, please go right now to kera.org or call 888-694-6931 or call or go online and make that contribution. And of course, we have our guest's book today available as a thank you gift to any membership contribution over $120.
That's exactly right. The book is called The Arabs, A History by Eugene Rogan. It is really interesting. It's the sort of thing that I can imagine being used as a text in university classes where students are trying to sort of come in and understand how we have come to this point. But it's great for anyone who really cares about the news from this part of the world. There's a lot of insight here that is very clearly stated and very interestingly written as well. So we'd love to be able to offer that to you. You know, as Jeff mentioned, there are some people making leadership gifts today. There are other people making more modest gifts. It's always a challenge to sort of throw numbers out there because, look, we know for some of you, a $3,000 gift or $1,500 gift or a $10,000 gift is absolutely within sort of your financial limits and based on your generosity in the past is something that you have been called upon
sure.
to do. For others, we know out there, you know, $120 a year is significant and really important. All of those things and every level in between, above and below, really matters to the station. Whatever you can give, whatever you choose to give, really does make a difference and help your public radio station stay strong. We'd love to hear from you now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
We are really excited to have Eugene Rogan. He's the director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College in Oxford. On the phone today for the show, especially considering the Arab Spring that's been happening and all the movement. Chris is going to talk about all that stuff during the hour, but we're waiting right now to hear from you, and you have a couple of minutes before we get back to the conversation to make your contribution. Do it online at kera.org or go to the phone and call 888-694-6931.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Eugene Rogan. He is director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford. His book is called The Arabs, A History. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Eugene, what had the British and the French promised the Arab peoples or the world at large when deciding how to divide up control of this region?
Well, Britain and France had been following a whole range of different policies. They've been cutting secret deals between themselves on how to agree to split the lands in the event of the defeat of the Ottoman Empire. As that became a reality and Britain and France were in occupation of Arab territories, they then made a series of promises to people in the region concerned about their political future, promising that they would do all they could to ensure that the Arabs came to rule themselves and that their job was just there to assist them in this moment of transition into statehood. And I think in that, Britain and France were trying to buy a bit of calm for themselves while they got on with the real business of establishing borders and working out how they would rule these territories. And they had to do so in tandem with a new global organization called the League of Nations. Mm-hmm. And it was through the League that they would legitimate their new kind of empire in the Middle East through a series of mandates or territories over which great powers would help new countries into statehood.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have John on the line in Plano. Hi, John.
Hi, I just had a quick question. Your guest had mentioned a few minutes ago that Britain and France were very interested in the Arab territory, and I wondered why. Had oil started entering the equation at that point, or was there some other attraction of that territory to the Britons and the French?
Thanks for your call.
Great question. Definitely oil was a factor for Britain, less so for France. I think France was still thinking in terms of geostrategy of trying to consolidate its position in the Mediterranean world. Already it was in possession of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, which gave it a corner in northwest Africa, but was looking to try and secure a position around the Syrian coastline. And so they were looking for balancing, let's say, Britain's strong presence in Egypt with a really strong French presence in Syria. But for Britain, their first real interest in the region, having already established a very strong position in the Persian Gulf through a series of treaties with local sheikhs in what are now the United Arab Emirates, then were called the Trucial States, they were very keen to preserve the Persian Gulf as an area of strategic interest, and they were aware that oil had already been discovered in southern Iran and in northern Iraq. And as they had converted their fleet from coal-burning to oil-burning just before the First World War, they saw oil as a real strategic asset. And so I think if you look at the way Britain tried to redraft the map of the Middle East to favor its interests, it wanted to secure for itself control over Iraq, and it wanted to create a land bridge so they could do a pipeline for Iraqi oil to reach the Mediterranean. And that's where the connection between Iraq and Palestine came in, and why Palestine became such a strategic importance for Britain, and it sought to kind of redefine its agreements already struck with the French to secure a port for oil in Palestine.
We should note here that when those maps are being redrawn, even though there had not been a deep sense of nationalism from people on one side of the border or another within the Arab world, once those borders were drawn, people did, in fact, begin to identify nationally with their own people.
That's absolutely right, Chris. And I think that in a funny sort of way, if there's anything that Britain and France, as imperial powers, wanted to try and keep a lid on, it was nationalism. Hmm. But the two things that they provided that really encouraged nationalism was they drew the boundaries within which people started struggling for their national rights, and they provided a common enemy as the outside occupier against which what were in many cases very diverse populations, Christians, Muslims, Jews, from a wide range of different denominations and sects, all uniting together to overthrow the British or the French who were ruling them. So funnily enough, everything they did generated exactly the force they were hoping to try and forestall nationalism.
So World War II ended European imperialism in the Arab world. How did the different Arab states decide how they would be governed independently?
Well, I think there was a real legacy there as well. And not surprisingly, Britain, with its constitutional monarchy, had tried to create monarchical institutions in most of its territories. Palestine, the one exception, because they never could find a formula that both Jews and Arabs were willing to accept within the terms of the mandate, which allowed for continued creation of a Jewish national home in Palestine, along with the Balfour Declaration's promise of 1917. So leave Palestine aside for a moment. I know we'll get back to it.
Yeah, we will.
But if you look at Jordan, if you look at Egypt, if you look at Iraq, these are countries where the British tried to put in place monarchies governed by a constitution in which people were represented through a parliament. For the territories under French rule, they favored a republican system. So the Lebanese, the Syrians saw government structures created, not quite in replication of the Fourth Republic, but nonetheless, where a president was the executive and a parliament would be the legislature. And in a sense, that was what the newly independent governments of the Arab world after the Second World War inherited. But it was to be challenged very quickly by a new firebrand set of nationalists who found the old guard who were leading their countries had failed the people. And the real spark for that, I think, was the Arab defeat in 1948 in Palestine.
And that is, as you identify, really the second major turning point of the 20th century in the Arab world. How did the establishment of the State of Israel change international politics and alliances within the Middle East?
Oh, Chris, that is such a big question. I could give you quite an hour's lecture on that one alone. But I think, you know, if the First World War left us with a modern Middle East composed of distinct states, and it's pretty much the same set of states as we now know in the Middle East today, so that was the enduring legacy there. The defeat in Palestine, the loss of Palestine, created most of the problems that have bedeviled the Arab world ever since. The Palestinian refugee, of course, is a humanitarian crisis that has meant that displaced Palestinians live in camps in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, and even in Gaza and the West Bank, you have, you know, people who are refugees from 1948. So that enduring legacy and the stress that put on host governments is one element. But certainly the militarized status of the Arab world, which has been so detrimental to democratic politics and has led to such authoritarian forms of government, can be directly traced to a region on a war footing, because try though they might war after war, they never could defeat Israel and you know, take away what was the real threat to the Arab world at its very core. Palestine turned to Israel, suddenly changed the military balance in the region, and we're living with the consequences right down to the present day.
You mentioned earlier, Eugene, the Arab world's embrace of the Wilson administration and its sort of neutrality in that region. How did the U.S. shift from what had been a neutral position with regard to the State of Israel to its strong support of an alliance with Israel?
Well, I think the American relationship with Israel took a long time to develop. I know that the United States was the first country to confer recognition on Israel after it declared its statehood, very quickly followed by the Soviet Union within minutes of each other. But that did not mean that the United States was really sure that it approved of the Jewish state. The politics of Ben-Gurion and those around him were suspected by many in Washington of being far too communist-oriented, and many had argued for recognition to try and forestall Soviet influence. For its early years, the State of Israel wasn't really very close to the United States. It was reliant more on France for its arms supplies, and in fact had really gotten into trouble with the United States at the time of the Suez Crisis, when Israel colluded with Britain and France to occupy the Sinai Peninsula and the Suez Canal. And America, under President Eisenhower, forced the British, French, and Israelis to withdraw and restore Egypt's sovereignty over that territory. So really, right through the 1950s, you would not have characterized Israeli-American relations as strong. I think for that, we'd have to really look at the events of the Six-Day War in June 1967 to see a major turning point in American-Israel support.
So during the Cold War, much of the world was polarized, and you were on the side of the United States or you were on the side of the Soviet Union. How did that play out in the Arab world?
I think the Arab world actually was a beneficiary of the Cold War. In a funny sort of way, the global rules were easier to subvert when you could play one superpower against another. I mean, admittedly, the center of gravity still wasn't in the Arab world. The rules were being set by Washington or by Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
But the Arabs showed themselves quite capable of playing on American concerns about Soviet expansionism and on Soviet openness to do business without setting too many preconditions to try and achieve optimal benefits. And I think in that way, you can look at the behavior of Egypt, say, turning to the Soviets to get armed in the 1950s, Sadat expelling Soviet advisors in the early 1970s, only to get the Soviets to resupply him massively to prosecute a successful war in 1973, after which he dumped the Soviets to really come in on the American camp as soon as the Americans began taking him seriously. You could see where that fluidity of playing the Soviets off the Americans allowed the Arabs to sort of play their cards to their best advantage, even though they were, in global strategic terms, fairly weak partners.
Eugene Rogan is my guest. He's director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford. We're talking about his 2009 book, recently updated and now available in trade paperback, called The Arabs, A History. We'll resume our conversation with Eugene in just a moment. And if you'd like to be part of it, we invite you to call us at 1-800-933-5372. You're also welcome to send email to think@kera.org. We're taking a quick pause, hopefully a pause that we will be able to stop taking within a day or so, to remind you that we are in our spring fundraising campaign. This is that time of year when we raise the money that KERA needs to continue providing you programs like Think, like All Things Considered, like Morning Edition, like all the weekend programming, the programs that you listen to and rely on this station to provide you every day. You can show your support by going online to kera.org, where you can choose at or above the $120 level a thank you gift copy of Eugene Rogan's book, The Arabs, A History. You can also make that contribution on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Hello again, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank David Mosier and Laurel McMichael in Lantana, Mark Stanton in Dallas, Melissa Clark in Haltom City, Meg Sullivan in Ennis, Alex Stiegenberger in Dallas, Bill and Deborah Amos in Dallas. We also heard from John Davis in Colleyville, Mike and Linda Reed in Granbury, Matt Sands in Keller, Phil Kretschy in Corsicana, Jacob Kazmirski in Dallas, Gail and Mark Lanicki in Fort Worth, and Gene and Sharon Shields in Dallas. Thanks so much to each of you.
Thanks to all of those folks. Thanks also to Robert and Georgia Bradford of Richardson, Lisa Sims in Fort Worth. Thank you, Michael Kasargian in Dallas, Mac McConnon in Heath, Emily Miller and Mark Rosen in Dallas, Paula Lagergren in Dallas, Diana Elhard in Garland, Alan and Marsha Abison in Fort Worth, William and Rosalia Lumry in Dallas. Thank you all very much. We greatly appreciate your generosity.
You can join these great folks and help us chip away at the remaining $83,194 left to raise in this campaign with a call to 888-694-6931 or an online contribution. Just do it really quickly and easily there at kera.org. And if you'd like, if you're enjoying this conversation today, and I think it's really great today, the show, by the way, Chris, it's really, really illuminating.
I've learned a lot.
Yeah, it's fantastic. With Eugene Rogan, we can thank you at the $120 membership level with a copy of his book, The Arabs, A History. It's been re-released in paperback recently, and perfect timing, really, because the conversation about you know, the historical perspective on what's happening in the Middle East is really important right now. And, you know, we know that you believe it is as well. And so that's why we're thrilled to have him today. If you appreciate it, call us 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
If you have ever marveled at how this station based in North Texas is able to have not just regional or national, but global experts, thank yourself, because your dollars make it possible for that to happen. Your dollars make it possible for KERA to produce a show locally like Think, to have a producer like Jeff Whittington, who is a miracle worker with regard to booking people that sometimes I think is they're impossible, but he has a way of convincing people. You know, it allows us, you know, there are two two full-time staff members here working on this program for you because your dollars make it possible. It's expensive, honestly, to produce local programming. KERA is very committed to this, and your money makes it possible online at kera.org and over the phone at 1-888-694-6931.
What would you have to spend in time and money and effort to amalgamate what you get from KERA every single day? Think about what you hear on Morning Edition, straight through the Diane Rehm Show and Fresh Air, the Think Show here, and then afterward, you know, we have Tell Me More, we have The World, we have All Things Considered. We even you know, we have Marketplace, of course, every weeknight at 6:30, and we even broadcast the News Hour from PBS, the PBS News Hour, with Jim Lehrer and a couple of other folks sharing the hosting duties this day. I listen to the News Hour on 90.1 personally every night. Maybe I'm making dinner or I'm heading out to an event. I love getting the News Hour on KERA radio because I don't have a chance to watch it on television. And I can take it with me wherever I want to go, whether I'm listening on radio, in my car, or on my KERA app on my smartphone. It's incredible what you get from KERA every single day. Think about what it would cost for you to put that together yourself. How many newspapers, how many magazine subscriptions, how many online subscriptions
would
you need? And how much time? When all you have to do is just turn on the radio. And all we're asking for is for you to make a financial contribution. That's it. At any level, just do your part right now at KERA.org.
If your contribution is at or above the $120 level and you'd like a thank you gift, we do have copies of Eugene Rogan's book, The Arabs, A History. We have other thank you gifts as well if there's something that you have heard about. And remember that your dollars also make the podcasts available on the station. So many of you now, and I'm like this myself, there are programs that I listen to from public radio that I podcast in time shifts so I have time to really focus on them. If you listen to the podcast, we greatly appreciate the fact that you are listening, and we also count on you to help make it possible to continue providing this. There is a cost associated with producing this, and your dollars help to defray that cost and ensure that the podcast remains available whenever you want to get to it. Please make your contribution of support right now online at kera.org or go to the phones at 1-888-694-6931.
Just $83,000 and change left to raise. Of course, we could do that with one $83,000 contribution right now, or $8,300 contribution. You can do the math, or 100 people at $83. You do your part right now, please. Just please call 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
Thanks so much.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in Legos, writing, art, reading, math, and science held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus, Dallas. Learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford, Eugene Rogan. His book is called The Arabs, A History. If you want to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Gordon in Arlington. Hi, Gordon.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I have two questions.
Okay.
Hello?
Just give us one, because we've got other folks who might want to ask a question as well. Just give us your favorite.
Let me just ask one question then. What's the relation between the Europeans and the people in Libya in history and in present? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I can see why you're asking the question, Gordon. It's been a big mystery to me how the French President Sarkozy was able to get the British Prime Minister David Cameron to join in a coalition to intervene in Libya today, and you expect there to be deep historic roots to that. And there are. I think that Libya was the one last territory of North Africa not claimed by an imperial power by the time the new state of Italy in the late 19th century was trying to establish its imperial standing among the powers of Europe. And it took a while for them to get there. But in 1911, Italy declared war on the Ottoman Empire to claim that last bit of North African territory under Ottoman rule, the provinces of Benghazi and of Tripoli. And from 1911 until the 1930s, it was the Italians who would be the European imperial powers ruling over Libya. It was only at the height of the Second World War when the North African War led to an Italian withdrawal from Libya and the consolidation of North Africa under British and American control, that the Libyans were given the chance to establish their own government over this territory. It was the British who helped them usher that government into being, and they came into being in the early 1950s as a kingdom under King Idris of Libya. So really, it's been a history of Italian and British influence over the shaping of the modern state of Libya, and so perhaps that had some influence over the decision of Italy, France, and Britain to get involved in Libya today.
Talk about this with an eye toward what's taking place now in Libya and Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East. You remind us here that democracy is, in fact, not a new thing to the Arab world. And in the 19th century, there were leaders from Tunisia and Egypt who were exploring reforms that might, in fact, give people a greater stake in their own government. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that the critical point here is that already people in the Arab world were aware of the dangers of autocratic rule. And I think in the 19th century, the real concern was less about infringement on human rights than it was about overspending and overtaxation and getting indebted to Europe and putting countries at risk of being interfered with by more powerful, richer neighbors across the Mediterranean. So really, as early as the 1830s, you have the first major book written by, in this case, an Egyptian by the name of Tahtawi, describing the France that he visited as a sort of chaplain, a Muslim chaplain, to an educational mission. He didn't just talk about politics. He talked a lot about this strange and exotic society called France, at least it was strange and exotic to the Egyptians of the time. But as a part of that, he really spent a lot of his book, he translated every article of the French Constitution, and he tried to interpret it for an Arab, and the book was translated into Turkish, so an Ottoman readership, on how constitutional rule imposed rights and responsibilities on everyone in government, everyone in the country, from the ruler right down through the citizens, and how this was probably the missing key in the, let's say, the political weakness of states around the Mediterranean and the Ottoman Empire and North African territories, that if you could just get citizens elected by their peers to serve as a counterbalancing weight to rulers, and if you could impose some restrictions on rulers, that you could strike the balance that would bring prosperity and success to these countries. And that debate of a struggle against absolutism starting in the 1830s has really been one pursued actively right across the region through the 19th and early 20th century.
Tahtawi couldn't get his mind around the amount of freedom that women had in France in the 1830s, and I would think a lot of French women would not say that their great-grandmothers had that much freedom back then. But talk a little bit about the role of women today in the push for democracy in parts of the Arab world, and whether this time of change and upheaval will push forward that cause to a greater extent than it has been in decades past.
It's been the periods of political turmoil that women have really seized the opportunity to emerge from the domestic sphere, to really play an important role in public life. And those moments have also been the times when feminism has really gained steam in the region and where women began to pursue their own rights, as well as, let's say, the national objectives of independence or whatnot. In the early 20th century, already in 1919 in Egypt, for instance, the big demonstrations against British rule that were racking Egypt after the First World War led to the British basically exiling the male leadership of the nationalist movement. And they relied on their wives to lead the women of Egypt to be the kind of people leading nationalism that the British didn't dare touch. And I think it awakened in the women of Egypt a sense that they had played a tremendous role in their country's history, and that they wanted to capitalize on that to secure their position, a dignified position, in the political life of their country. And I see exactly the same impulse at work today, where we've seen in Tunisia and Egypt and other places where the Arab Spring has taken root, women standing side by side with men, facing the same dangers, showing the same courage, to demand the fall of autocratic governments and to demand respect for human rights and for accountable government. And they want, as part of that, that women will play a part as equals with men in their societies. and one only hopes that they will be able to consolidate their gains and not be forced back into the domestic sphere once again.
What variables will be most important in determining whether the Arab Spring turns into something that provides lasting democratic benefits for the people who are being governed?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Chris. And I think, in a sense, we have to look to the two countries that have really achieved the successful revolutions, Tunisia and Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
These are the countries that have the best established political institutions. They have judiciaries that show signs of being very independent. They have parliaments. Admittedly, the parliaments have behaved like rubber stamps, but the moment you elect free-thinking people into the legislature of these countries, those parliaments will be quite different. They have constitutions, admittedly constitutions that have been deformed to meet the needs of autocracies, but they're changing their constitutions to restore their liberal qualities. And so they have the institutions, they have the experience of party political life, and I think the accomplishments of the Tunisians and the Egyptians, you know, whatever the highest state of political freedoms they secure for their peoples through this process of transition they're going through, will set the high benchwater mark that people across the Arab world will aspire to. It's just going to take the others a lot longer to get there.
I want to close with this, Eugene. What you give us here is a great context of the amount of suffering that Arab peoples have endured for centuries, which is not really the way that a lot of sort of Westerners approach the history of this part of the world. Can you talk about why we have somehow been, we've had blinders on with regard to this element of Arab history?
Well, I wouldn't want to try and characterize Arab history as a kind of lachrymose history of suffering people, because it wouldn't do justice to all the ways in which the Arabs have proven to be such interesting, rich, and dynamic people. You know, I started my book by recounting the death of a very courageous Lebanese journalist named Samir Kassir. And Kassir was so inspired by the kind of secular society he grew up with, where you had, you know, the third worldism of Abdel Nasser. You had the emergence of a national cinema in Egypt, where he saw the development of the Arab novel as something that showed a dynamic, vibrant culture challenging boundaries. And if I wanted to make Western readers aware of the pressures Arabs have been under in modern history, maybe I succeeded better in conveying that in the book than I did of this rich and diverse culture that is such an important part of world culture today, but which we continue to see through the lenses of violence and terrorism, never more so than since the aftermath of 9/11.
Eugene Rogan is director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony's College at Oxford. His most recent book, out now in trade paperback and updated, is called The Arabs, A History. Eugene, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
No, Chris, it's been a real pleasure being with you, and I'm so delighted you're giving books away. If any of your readers want an inscribed copy, if they send me their address by email, I'd be glad to send them a little insertion slip that they can put into their books as a token of my gratitude as well.
That's so nice of you. Thank you so much. My name is Chris Boyd. We appreciate all of you who have been listening this hour, all of you who have participated in the show, and especially we appreciate those of you who are supporting members of KERA. If you are ready to join this esteemed group of listeners who really take action to provide for public radio in this community, you can go online now to kera.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931. As we just discussed, we do have copies available of The Arabs, A History, Eugene Rogan's book, available as thank you gifts at or above the $120 contribution level this afternoon. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. We're really excited. I was really excited, and as I mentioned earlier, to have Eugene Rogan on the show today. Next hour is going to be just as cool. Ellen Prager, marine scientist, talking about all the creatures in the sea that maybe we don't know really that much about. And this is a scientist who spent, I think, literally months living underwater.
She goes for a couple weeks at a time,
yeah,
in this little like a Airstream trailer under the sea.
So that's going to be a lot of fun. So take a moment right now and go to KERA.org, make your contribution, or call 888-694-6931. Just $82,024 left to raise. And that means that we've, during the show today, raised about $2,000 so far. That's good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to those of you who've called or contributed online. We still want to hear from you, though, if you have yet to make your gift of support. 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
$81,904 left to raise in this fundraising campaign. Your contribution now will take a bite out of that amount. If you are not ready to, say, you know, put a large amount of money on your credit card or on your debit card right now, you might think about setting up a sustaining membership where you can divide out the amount of what would be an annual contribution. And just month after month after month, that amount transfers into KERA's account. Those accounts, the great thing about them for a lot of people is that once you set them up, they're done. Unless you want to change something, you remain a current sustaining member of KERA, and that works out really well for people. If you want to make a contribution at or above the $120 level, that would just be the $10 a month, and we can thank you with a copy of Eugene Rogan's book, The Arabs, A History.
We still have Think Mugs as well available when you join the station with the $60 contribution. You can see it online at KERA.org. It's a black ceramic mug. It says has the Think logo on it. We give them sometimes to guests who are on the show, and they're always really excited to have the token of our esteem. And we would love to share one with you as well when you support the station. And your $60 contribution is just $5 a month when you become a sustaining member. But check that out at KERA.org or when you talk to the friendly person on the phone when you call 888-694-6931.
We know that some of you don't choose to take a thank you gift. That's fine, too. In that case, we take all of the contribution and put it to work. You know, as I'm sure you figured out, if you take a thank you gift, then you make the gift of support and we spend a little of that buying the thank you gift
sure.
to send to you. But we're happy to do it because if that is some of you, I understand, you feel like if you're going to make a contribution, you want some kind of object in your hand besides just the programming for the year. And we're happy to oblige you. And if there's something that you've heard about throughout the course of the last couple of weeks, it may still be available. So just go online to KERA.org and you can check that out there. You can also make your contribution at 1-888-694-6931. Both of those places will accept contributions as well from podcast listeners. We know that you are growing in number all the time. You are all over the country, all over the world. Your contributions help make it possible for us to bring you the podcast every day.
888-694-6931. Online at KERA.org. It is 90.1 KERA Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. Also 100.1 K261 CW Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman. But no matter where you listen, you're listening to your public radio station. Don't expect somebody else to pay for the station. Please do your part right now. We just have $81,904 left to raise during the membership campaign. We're chipping away at that total. Remember, we started looking for $625,000 to maintain our fiscal health here at KERA and raise the money that's necessary to continue to bring you the programming. Programming like what you just heard this last hour and programming like what you're going to hear next hour. That's what pays for it. We've made a huge progress in the last couple of weeks thanks to so many people, but we're still waiting to hear from you. And there's still time for you to get involved in the successful conclusion of this membership campaign.
We know how easy, how temptingly easy it is to let somebody else sort of pick up your share of the public radio bill in North Texas. It's almost like, you know, if you were to go to a meeting and you arrive 5 minutes early and you see everybody setting up the chairs for the meeting, it would be really hard to just sit down in two of those chairs and put your feet up on one and say, oh, I'll let everybody else take care of this, because there would be people around you who were doing this work, who were shouldering the load, and you would want to help out. It's sort of the same way with public radio. If you could see all the people, that's one reason that we like to read names out. If you could hear about people like Lee Walker in Coppell and Stacy Paddock in Dallas and Mary and Joe Duell in Fort Worth and Daniel Gonzalez in Arlington, if you could see them on their computers making their contributions, whipping out their credit cards, making these phone calls, it might be harder to say, I'm not going to be part of this. So try to picture them and picture yourself making a gift of support to KERA.
Yeah, if you were in a theater and we asked, or an arena, and we asked everybody who listens to the station. By the way, 400,000 people listen to the station every week, and you're one of those people, and we're thrilled to have you. But if we asked for a show of hands of who supported the station, fewer than 1 in 10 of those people in the stadium would raise their hands. So the question is, would you raise your hand Would you make the decision there to support the station? Because if you could really see the disparity between the number of people who listen and the number of people who give, then you'll understand why these membership campaigns take as long as they do. Because we, it's tough. It's tough to convince you to pay for something that you can get for free, but we hope to continue. That's why we're continuing. We hope to convince you.
Because it's not free to provide the programming to you. KERA has expenses, and your contributions help to pay, essentially, your public radio bill. We would love to hear from you now online at kera.org or over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.